Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's broadcast, spotlight on Pope Benedict's letter to the Chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany, Angela Merkel. Look back at the Pope's Sunday homily focusing on the conversion of St. Augustine of Hippo, Bishop and Doctor of the Church. And admiring an artistic masterpiece in the Church of St. Mark the Evangelist here in Rome. Well, thanks very much for joining me once again. Pope Benedict XVI has been writing weighty letters recently to express not only his concern for the question of global poverty, with specific concern for Africa, but also his gratitude as leader of the Catholic Church to the person he addressed the letter to for keeping this issue on agenda. The agenda being that of the seven leading economic powers plus Russia, known as G8. And the person he addressed the letter to, as I said a moment ago, is its president, currently the Chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany, Dr. Angela Merkel. In the letter, the Pope highlights how the Holy See has repeatedly insisted that while governments of poorer countries have a responsibility with regard to good governance and the elimination of poverty, the active involvement of international partners is indispensable. Not to be seen as an extra or as a concession which could be postponed in the face of pressing national concerns. The Pope then went on to write that it is a grave and unconditional moral responsibility founded on the unity of the human race and on the common destiny of rich and poor alike, who are being drawn ever closer by the process of globalization. Trade conditions favourable to poor countries, including above all broad and unconditional access to markets, should be made available and guaranteed in lasting and reliable ways, and provision made for the rapid and unconditional cancellation of external debt of heavily indebted poor countries and of the least developed countries. Among other things, in this letter the Pope highlighted the need for substantial investment of resources for research and for the development of the medicines to treat AIDS, TB, malaria and other tropical diseases, but also the need for the international community to work for substantial reduction of both the legal and the illegal arms trade, the illegal trade of precious raw materials and the flight of capital from poor countries, as well as the elimination of money laundering and corruption of officials. People from different religions and cultures throughout the world are convinced that achieving the goal of eradicating extreme poverty by the year 2015 is one of the most important tasks in today's world. Moreover, the Pope writes, they also hold that such an objective is indissolubly linked to world peace and security. Commenting on this letter, the director of the Holy See's press office, Jesuit Father Federico Lombardi, highlighted the importance of this missive, pointing out how it dispels speculation as to Pope Benedict's alleged Eurocentricism on the eve of a journey which takes him to yet another continent, Latin America. When the Pope refers to Europe, Father Lombardi specifies, he envisages this continent as being open to the world in terms of justice and solidarity, having at heart the realization of a world which respects the dignity of each human person. In his 2 years as Pope, Pope Benedict has often spoken out against the scandal of poverty, highlighted the issues affecting the African continent, including during his traditional Christmas and Easter messages to the city and to the world, and also during his annual speech to the diplomatic corps. And now it's time to join one of the fathers of the Church, who Pope Benedict spoke about at length in northern Italy on Sunday, when he went to Pavia. For 12 centuries, this city has been the resting place of St. Augustine of Hippo, Father and Doctor of the Church. And naturally, it was to this Father of the Church that the Pope dedicated most of his homily at the Mass he celebrated there.
La città di Pavia parla di uno dei più grandi convertiti della storia della Chiesa, Sant'Aurelio Agostino. Egli morì.
Augustine, whose writings are considered to be central to the developing of both Western theology and Western thought in the first millennium, among them the City of God and of Free Choice of the Will. But perhaps most widely read are his Confessions. I personally even came across this big fat book in a taxi here in Rome. Asking the taxi driver if someone had left the book behind, he told me that it was his current reading. And on Sunday in Pavia, it was precisely to these confessions that Pope Benedict referred to in his homily.
Nel suo libro Confessioni, Agostino ha illustrato in modo toccante il cammino della sua conversione.
As he focused on this saint's conversion, of which he described three phases in detail, the gist of the message being that, like Augustine, we too may be tormented by a personal quest for the truth and a personal relationship with God. And that's why we as Christians today should emulate him. There is no need for me to say how much this regards us, the Pope said in Italian. We should remain people who seek, who are not content with what others do and say.
Che Agostino in una lunga lotta interiore dovette percorrere per ricevere finalmente nella notte di Pasqua 387.
As we all know, Pope Benedict himself was greatly influenced by the figure of Saint Augustine, as constantly referred to him in his writings and speeches. And though he lived some nearly 1,600 years ago, I'm told that, but haven't verified, that Augustine's life and writing influenced beyond my Roman taxi driver artists through the ages, including Bob Dylan, Sting, and even the Rolling Stones, not exactly a gallery of church fathers. So what was this conversion Pope Benedict spoke about at length on Sunday, referring to St. Augustine and his confessions? And anyway, why not discover more about this giant figure from our family tree of faith? One of my colleagues knows quite a bit about him. She's Jill Bevilacqua. Stay tuned.
In an introduction to a modern collection of the writings of the Bishop of Hippo, these words appear.
Man, who is but a portion of your creation, wishes to praise you. You excite him so that he may find pleasure in praising you, because you made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you.
If we were faced with the unlikely proposition of having to destroy completely either the works of Augustine or the works of all the other fathers and writers, I have little doubt that all the others would have to be sacrificed. Augustine must remain.
Perhaps the most familiar name of all, and certainly the most quoted, Augustine is of all the fathers the most approachable because the most human. No one of all the fathers has so won the minds and hearts of men of all times and all nations as the gentle, lovable Bishop of Hippo.
Who then was Augustine?
Born at Tagaste in Numidia on November the 13th, 354, Aurelius Augustinus was the son of Patricius, a well-born pagan who became a Christian shortly before his death, and Monica, almost as famous as her son, and of whom it was said, "It is impossible that the son of these tears should perish." For Augustine, as one biography puts it, in spite of the influence of his mother, lived until the age of 32, a life defiled morally by license and intellectually by Manichaeism.
But Augustine, as a reliable modern scholar tells us, was no worse than his fellow students of respectable families, and probably much better than most of them. At 17, he went to Carthage to pursue more advanced rhetorical studies. In Carthage, our scholar tells us, he was soon led into the luxury of the immoral life of that city. But his reminiscences on this matter need not be taken too literally. Nevertheless, we know that, much to his mother's chagrin, he took a concubine who gave him a son, Adeodatus. At 19, he was attracted by philosophy, and after reading Cicero, aspired to become a true lover of wisdom. He read the scriptures, but they did not satisfy him. He had been a catechumen, but postponed his baptism, and in 374 joined the Manichees, who claimed to lead men to the study and knowledge of truth. But when he finally met Faustus, the leader of the sect, Augustine was disillusioned by the ignorance of the man, and soon after went to Rome, and later to Milan, where he secured the chair of rhetoric. Here he heard the sermons of Ambrose, and gradually the preaching of the great bishop began to take effect.
Ambrose was a lawyer, a philosopher, a man of the highest rank, and his coherent account of the scriptures, presenting God as the true source of all wisdom, disturbed and drew Augustine. At the same time, he was reading Neoplatonist works, and his mind was gradually lifted from the things of the world of sense to the world of reason, from the material to the spiritual. After long conflict, he heard one day a mysterious voice telling him to take up and read. He took up and read the passage from Romans chapter 13, and his doubts were at last ended. He gave up his teaching, took his mother and son, and with some friends retired to an estate near Milan. During Lent, he received instruction, and on Easter night 387, he was baptized by Ambrose. A few months later, he set out for Africa. His mother died at Ostia, after they had together experienced contemplation of God.
The story of Augustine's conversion he tells himself in his Confessions, one of the great books of all time, an autobiography which is at the same time a hymn of praise to God. A book, it is said, that reveals the depths of the human soul, perhaps more completely than any book yet written. Rather than a confession of faults, it is an acknowledgement of God, and tells of the work of salvation God wrought in bringing its author from sin to grace. At the beginning, he lays down the principle, "You have made us for yourself, and our heart is restless till it rests in you." Augustine then proves by his own experience the truth of this principle.
I found myself far from you in a region of dissension, and it was as if I heard your voice from on high. I am the food of adults. Grow, and you shall eat me. You will then not change me into yourself, like the food of your flesh, but you shall be changed into me. And I came to know that you corrected man for his wickedness, and you made my soul shrivel up like a moth. And I said, "Is truth nothing at all then, because it has no extension in space, either finite or infinite?" And you called out from afar, "I am who am." And I heard as one hears in his heart, and there was no longer any grounds in me for doubt. I would more easily have doubted my own existence than I would have doubted that truth is that which is clearly seen, being understood through the things that are made.
After a few years of monastic life back in Tagaste, Augustine was ordained priest by Bishop Valerius of Hippo, who insisted only 4 years later on consecrating him as coadjutor bishop. "I was caught and made a priest, and once that step had been taken, I was made a bishop." To his friends who congratulated him, Augustine retorted that he had made a shipwreck of himself, and that the God who made him had remade him. One of his reasons for writing the Confessions had been to avoid vainglory.
Augustine succeeded Valerius in 395 and was soon expounding the Bible to his flock. From the time he was ordained until his death 40 years later, Augustine preached regularly on Sundays and feast days and frequently throughout the week. His extant sermons amount to something more than 1,000, but it has been calculated that had all his sermons been recorded, they would probably run to 7,000 or 8,000.
Apart from the conversion of his own flock, Augustine believed his mission to be that of the conversion of heretics and pagans, of whom he had once been one. Frequently, he debated in public with the Manichees, the Donatists, and the Pelagians, whom he pursued until the heresy was condemned in Rome. The aged Jerome wrote to him on hearing the news, "Hail to thee! The world resounds with thy praise. The Catholics admire thee as the restorer of the ancient faith." Augustine was a passionate orator, but unlike Jerome, had no instinct for invective. He believed that heresies were the products of thinking men, and in reply to them, he offered his thoughts.
Augustine's greatest work, The City of God, was written in answer to an objection raised by the pagans, who accused the Christians of being responsible for the fall of the empire. Christians, they said, had sapped its strength by the doctrine of meekness and non-violence, and the old gods had avenged themselves. Augustine retorted that Rome was made great not by the gods, but by her republican virtues, and then by her Christian subjects. The cause of her present defeat, he said, was her unbridled luxury and failure to accept Christianity. Augustine then went on to delineate two cities founded on two kinds of love: the city of God, founded on the love of God and of truth, and the city of earth, founded on the love of self and of pleasure. Tell me what a people loves, and I shall tell you what it is. The City of God is recognized as the earliest known theology of history. It's an explanation of how one can be in this world and not of it. Augustine tells us what is awaiting us in the world to come.
How great will be that happiness where there will be no evil, where no good will remain hidden, where there will be leisure for the praises of God, who shall be all in all. What power of movement such bodies will have there, I have not the rashness to boldly define, because I have not the ability to conceive of it. Nevertheless, I will say that both in motion and at rest, in their appearance, they shall be handsome, in that place where anything that is not handsome will not be. Certainly the body shall immediately be wherever the spirit wills it to be. Nor will the spirit will anything which were unbecoming, either to the spirit or to the body. There the reward of virtue shall be God himself, the author of virtue. And he promised himself, than whom there can be nothing better or greater. For thus too is that to be rightly understood which the apostle says, that God may be all in all. He himself will be the end of our desires. He shall be seen without end. He shall be loved without surfeit. He shall be praised without weariness. There we shall rest and we shall behold. We shall behold and we shall love. We shall love and we shall praise. This is what shall be in the end without end.
In Augustine's last years, the empire was close to collapse. In 430, the Vandals laid siege to Hippo, where the 76-year-old bishop was fatally ill. But Augustine refused to flee the city. When the people remain and the ministers flee and the ministration is suspended, what is that but the guilty flight of hirelings who care not for the sheep? Augustine prayed God to liberate the city, or give his subjects fortitude to endure, or otherwise to take me to himself from this world. And on the 28th of August, 430 AD, Augustine was taken from this world. Thank you.
the genius of Augustine is acknowledged by all scholars of past and present. None wrote so well or so much, and in modern times none other has been so much written about. He was unique in his time, and none like him has since been seen.
He was the source from which almost the entire range of theological knowledge in the Middle Ages was derived.
He combined holiness with knowledge, speculation with faith, and action with contemplation in an unparalleled degree.
With princely generosity, he scattered along his way ideas in which later thinkers found the materials for entire systems of doctrine.
His words were often the origin of dogmatic controversy that have agitated powerfully more than one generation of mankind.
Ecclesiastical authority, both conciliar and pontifical, has always reckoned him among the chief doctors of the Church.
He was one of those mighty spirits that appear only at great intervals of time, but are destined to influence very profoundly the destiny of humanity.
This, then, was Augustine.
Well, thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua and to Jean-Patrick Labbert, who produced the programme and was also one of the speakers. But now let's turn the page and leave St. Augustine behind us. Some artwork focusing around the figure of St. Mark the Evangelist, whose feast day falls on the 25th of April. The Evangelist with the winged lion as symbol, and an Evangelist to whom is dedicated a church right in the heart of Rome. Stay tuned as I visit there with a professor of fine arts. She's Breda Innes, a familiar voice to listeners. The Basilica of St. Mark the Evangelist.
The church you know is there, but you never see it.
That's right.
Until you have a reason to go there.
Once you get into the church, if you make a beeline for the Confessio, which kind of hides the apse in a way, you'll find a fresco of St. Mark. Needless to say, this church is dedicated to St. Mark. St. Mark the Evangelist?
Yes, big surprise.
The hand here somehow seems a little bit familiar. I think we've spoken about this artist before. He's from the 1600s and his name is?
Yeah, Romanelli. Romanelli, 1627 more or less, or 1627, 67, whatever. And as you can see, it takes up the entire central part of the bottom part of the apse. And again, this is famous for the fact that it was done in 6 days in honour of a war, or a battle, let's say, won by two generals from Venice, one of whom was from the family Marcello. So here we are with this allegory of Venice, where you have St. Mark with flowing red robes and a pale lilac robe underneath. He's defending the faith, which of course these battles were about, which is represented by a woman up there on the left-hand side, right up in the corner, in an area of light, this woman holding a cross. And then underneath, you see the lion with some little angels. And over on the other side, there are a couple of other angels. And then a defeated person in the battle just lying on the ground. So it's Mark portrayed almost in military terms here. You see Mark in a role that you don't normally link to him. But I suppose when you think of the battles fought to defend the faith, logical that in certain moments maybe you'd have this combination of gospel, evangelist and military person. But as you can see, that very Baroque painting, or let's say it's a mix of Baroque and Mannerist in the style of Federico Zuccari here. It's divided up beautifully. In the background you have this sky of blue, and then in the intermediary areas there, just to highlight the figures, you have these sort of grey clouds floating around St. Mark, around the woman holding the cross. And then it clears up very much so on the right-hand side, where you have more temporal figures lying on the ground and little trees in the background in the right-hand corner. And then below, a lion lying on the ground, looking actually a little bit bored, to be quite frank. obviously the symbol of this evangelist is the lion, and he's accompanying him everywhere in every image you see of St. Mark from time memorial. But maybe it's the artist had a little sense of humour that he puts him in an, almost like a human position, the way he's just sort of flat out on the floor thinking, oh, I'm exhausted after the battle. A little irony, a little fun there. And maybe the artist himself, who had to do the painting, the fresco, in 6 days, was exhausted as well. But it's a glorious, dramatic figure of St. Mark here, because generally he's portrayed as an older man and rather sedate, etc. Here you have him sort of widely gesturing. See all these lovely diagonal movements. His right hand is pointing towards the woman who represents faith. His left hand is pointed down towards the angels and the lion. Then his right leg is going out towards the other side of the painting. So there's like a torsion. He is the figure holding everything that happens in this fresco together. He's a sort of catalyst. He's the centre of the hurricane, let's say. Yes, he's the centre of the hurricane.
That goes for the movement. And what about the colour, Breda? How would you comment on that?
Well,
it's very soft, isn't it?
Very soft and pale. Probably a little bit faded with time as well. I would imagine that the original colours here were stronger. But here you have, as you can see, pale pink and red on the robes of Mark. And then what would have been a pale violet robe as well. Then our lion below is palish brown. And then the lady who's representing the faith, holding the cross, again, she seems like a sort of grey-white figure lost in an attenuated yellow glow. And if you look down at the end, you can see there are little steps. The top of the choir, in order to give this fresco a sense of distance from the choir below, the painter was very smart. He put two steps with the perspective to push the painting back into the wall, to give a sense of that you're walking out of the actual area and into a space behind the main altar. And this was a very common thing you see in the paintings of the Renaissance, and also you see in lots of paintings in Venice as well. So there are little elements of Venice. You can feel the sense of Venice here.
It's very much linked to Venice, this church, because it's the titular church of the Patriarch of Venice, and has been for a while.
Yes, you can see there are many tombs of Venetian figures here. St. Mark, he's buried in Venice, so there's a very strong link. So it's Mark, the lion, Venice, Rome, the Pope. You just get this strong kind of friendly link for the Venetians in Rome.
Well, thanks there go to Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Innes, who's currently working at the American University of Rome. That brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. If you should wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now, and remember, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to tune in then.
Laudator Jesus Christus.